Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae on News Talk.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McCrae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading and rating. Coming up on this week's programme, we're going to talk about the ET Code of Conduct. And that's what it's actually called, the ET Code of Contact. And this is what you're supposed to do and what the protocols are if you, as an astronomer or even someone just looking up into the sky, sees something unusual, something that could be aliens. It's not out of the question, as we'll hear in a few minutes. It's not out of the question. Life is out there. The question is, what do we do if we find it? Really interesting document, and a really interesting person we're going to be talking to about this series of protocols. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us at science@newstalk.com. We get to all of those comments at the end of the pod. First, though, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. We're joined by Matthew Campbell, Professor of Neurovascular Genetics in Trinity, and Dr. Ruth Freeman, Director of Research for Society at Research Ireland. You're both very welcome. Our first story, Matthew, has to do with the way we see.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting study that came out of the Johns Hopkins in Baltimore in the US. And really, it heavily focused on the development of the retina at the back of the eye, and not just the retina, but the very specific part of the retina that allows us to see very, very high resolution, you know, visual acuity. And really interestingly, what this group did was they used what are called retinal organoids. So believe it or not, we're able to grow retinas in a dish, full human retinas. They take 9 months, the same length of time it takes for gestation to occur. It takes 9 months to develop these in vitro or in a lab dish. And what these scientists did basically was they were trying to figure out how the very, very center of the retina works. The center of the retina is called the macula. So people will have heard of age-related macular degeneration or AMD. Sometimes in diabetes, we hear of diabetic macular edema. If you have damage to your macula, you're going to know about it because it mediates all of your central vision. So if you have damage to your macula, you can't see faces, you can't read. And really, at the very center of the macula, there's a small area called the fovea. So all of the high-resolution color vision that we see is mediated by 500 microns. So half a millimeter of cells density. Okay? Wow. It's absolutely incredible. And we don't really fully understand how that develops. How does the fovea at the center of the macula develop? Now, these retinal organoids, when you can grow human retinas in a dish, you can understand that. We have three types of cone photoreceptors. So cones, you'll remember, are the photoreceptors that allow us to see color vision. There are three types, red, green, and blue, that spectrum of light, basically. So they produce these materials that allow them to distinguish the different wavelengths of light. And what we know of is that the red and the green photoreceptors, the cones, are right in the very, very center, and the blue ones are on the outside. Now, what this group did was they discovered that when these retinal organoids were growing in a dish, that if you feed them a derivative of vitamin A, we know there's lots of vitamin A in carrots, a derivative of vitamin A called retinoic acid, that what happens is people used to think that the blue photoreceptors were pushed out to the side and the red and the green would then be centered. But what actually happens is when you supplement them with vitamin A, the actual red and green, the blue photoreceptors turn from blue into green or red. Huh. So rather than being pushed to the side, they're actually genetically changing from blue to red or green. So it's the first kind of clue as to how this fovea and these cone photoreceptors at the very center of the macula are actually developing. So super interesting and amazing that we can use this technology, retina in a dish, to understand how the human retina develops.
Is it theoretically possible that we could find a way to then change the color of these cones to restore full color vision to people who have color blindness?
Absolutely. So achromatopsia, absolutely. There are gene therapies being developed for that. You can think of a scientific or a science fiction type of way as well, that can we, you know, genetically reprogram humans to actually see in infrared, you know? Genetically, this is theoretically possible. It's absolutely not ethical, but genetically, these things are possible. But to your point, absolutely, there are clinical trials underway for achromatopsia and color blindness.
Yeah, I was speaking to a guy a few years back. It stuck with me. He was a biohacker, and he'd found a way to be able to see in pitch darkness using using these droppers. So he got a dropper that dilated the pupil, and so he could walk around a forest and see perfectly well. Now, if someone flipped on a light, he would blind himself permanently. So it was not a great thing to be messing around with. But, like, you know, there's lots of people thinking about interesting things with their vision. So this seems like research that may have a more medical application, though. So it's quite interesting. Our second story, Ruth, has to do with cancer research papers.
Yeah, and maybe not what we want to hear about cancer research papers, which is that there might be some issues with quite a large number of them. And I guess the background to this is that scientific publishing has exploded over the last two decades. So Matthew and I were just talking, like 20 years ago as scientists, you would kind of feel you could stay on top of a lot of the new publishing that was happening. Nowadays, there's just hundreds of thousands of things being published every year. And I guess because of this huge growth in publishing, what we've seen is these sort of dark businesses appearing called paper mills. And these are companies that essentially create bogus research and sell it to people. You know, they will sell authorships or they will offer to put your name on a paper and submit it to a journal. And of course, the reason this is happening is that, you know, for many years, the whole currency of scientific careers and scientific progression has been, you know, how many papers you have published. Thankfully, we're kind of moving away from some of that now, trying to look at quality of research, not quantity, but certainly quantity of papers published was a factor that people looked at before.
I mean, it still is in a...
It still yeah. is probably to some degree and probably more in some systems. So what we've seen as well, though, you know, people are aware of this issue. The number of retractions that are happening in scientific papers is also going up hugely. But this research is from the Queensland University of Technology, and it was published this week in the BMJ. And what these researchers did was they analysed 2.6 million cancer research papers that were published between 1999 and 2024. And they used a very sophisticated machine learning system called BERT, which was developed by Google to really look for natural patterns in speech. So a lot of large language models just look at the sequence of words one after the other. This is much better at looking at overall patterns. And they trained the model on known paper mill journals. So the model learned to spot what were the kind of patterns that these paper mill journals used. And then they went and analysed all of these cancer research papers. The system seemed to be very accurate. So on the training data, it could identify paper mill papers over 90% of the time. But then when they looked at the real data, they found 250,000 of those 2.6 million papers looked like they had been generated by paper mills. And what was interesting was the pattern, because when you go back to the early 2000s, it was only about 1% of all the papers. But by the time you get to 2022, it was nearly 16% of the papers. And interestingly, they found a real link between certain cancer types. I think liver cancer was one of them. And they also found the authorships were often linked to medical professionals, particularly in China. So for career progression in China, if you're a nurse or a doctor, you have to have publications. And they actually found these companies, not only were they creating these papers, but they were targeting them towards these healthcare professionals.
So that's obviously, I mean, 16% is an enormous amount. And of course, this is hugely problematic. What about the significance of these papers? Because, you know, the scientific community moves slowly, but if a big paper makes a big claim, there's a lot of evidence required. Do these 16% have any real impact on the real world application of medicine? Because there's two things, right? The first is does anyone read these papers, or are they just sort of, you know, junk at the bottom of the journal? But the second question is, what if patients find these journals, which were increasingly patients are accessing AI tools to be able to try and find some sort of cure for their loved one? They might find this junk science paper that has no evidence that, you know, that they then want to get a treatment and they take a hospital time. Like, there's a lot of issues with this.
Yeah, there are. And look, I think you're right. I think for a lot of credible scientists, you know, these kind of papers, they will eventually, you know, they won't take them seriously. But you can imagine, I mean, one, you know, AI models will be scraping all the publication literature. So if scientists and researchers or patients, anyone is using scraped data, you know, this data won't be differentiated from really robust data. So that's one issue. But I also think it's just a huge waste of time in the scientific community, even if only a small number of researchers are reading this and maybe attempting to revalidate science that has just been made up. You know, that's a huge cost. Often it's publicly funded research. So I think it is a big issue. But I mean, the silver lining to this paper is that the researchers have developed a tool now, which they're trialing with publishers, which would essentially weed these papers out before they go anywhere.
Now, yeah, but you could, then you write an AI tool.
An AI arms race, I know. Yeah, exactly. The Red Queen. you just keep running to stay in the same place. But still, I mean, I think, you know, that's a positive out of this, that even if this helps to stem the tide for a while, and places like China and Pakistan, Iran, where a lot of these papers are coming from, some of those countries are also taking action themselves. I mean, China is taking huge amounts of action to really clamp down on this kind of bogus publishing. So
hopefully, it's really harmful to international really reputation harmful. Of
yeah.
science.
Exactly.
You know, like, and you know, since I've been on this program, whenever we talk about bogus papers, claims that are not quite right, a lot of that seems to be associated with China. Although we do see retractions from other countries, but China does seem to be a big player here. Matthew, our third story has to do with T-Rex.
Yeah, so if you've ever been to an auction, you'll experience the, you know, the excitement of bids going in for a painting or a cow
or a house
or whatever type of auction you're going to. There was an auction this week in New York City in Sotheby's auction house, and believe it or not, the thing that was up for sale was a T-Rex named Gus. And when you scrape the surface of this and look at the details of this, it was an incredibly intact specimen of a T-Rex. So it's almost 80% complete of a 67 million year old T-Rex.
Wow.
And it was for sale on the private market. Okay. It had a guide price of 20 to 30 million. And I checked this morning and it actually sold for $50 million. So some private buyer, anonymous, now owns an almost fully complete T-Rex, one of the best preserved T-Rex. The T-Rex has bite marks on its side. It's got bite marks on its head, likely from another T-Rex. There's so much information in this fossil. That's absolutely incredible. Now, if you had endless amount of money, would you buy a T-Rex?
Yes.
There's the answer. I kind of veer that way as well. If I had endless amount of money, I'd love to buy a T-Rex. I was talking to Ruth beforehand. If I had a huge big house in the atrium of the house, I'd love to have a fully preserved T-Rex. But the issue is that these fully preserved fossils and beautifully preserved fossils that have lots of information in them, if they're owned by the private sector and an individual who owns them decides that that is theirs, nobody else is going to see this, that's for their eyes only, that is a major problem for society and a major problem for science. This fossil was found in the US. It was found on a farm by a man named Gus, hence it's called Gus. In the US, there are no restrictions as to if you find fossils, they belong to you. In some jurisdictions in South America and places like Mongolia, if you find a fossil of a dinosaur, it belongs to the state. The same way here, if you find a Bronze Age item, it belongs to the state. It doesn't belong to you. So this has thrown up a lot of controversy in the paleontology community of, you know, how are paleontologists and scientists now going to get access to this incredibly preserved specimen? And the answer is we don't know yet. And it's thrown out this almost philosophical debate of where do we go from here? Like, how do we deal with scientific findings like fossils that are owned in the private sector? Do we bring in laws that allow us to, you know, if you're going to buy this, there's a stipulation that you have to make it available to science for, you know, how many days per year? That's maybe an idea. Those laws don't exist. In the US at the moment, whoever bought that T-Rex for $50 million now owns it completely, and it's up to them whether or not paleontologists get access to it.
If I had $50 million and like it was on guide price for $20 million, if I had $50 million, I'd spend $1 million making a replica version of it, right? And then I would have a little entrance for scientists to come in and they can just take a bone, swap it out, go and do their research and bring it back. And I get to keep the T-Rex. Everybody's happy.
Absolutely. Everyone will be happy. But the issue is that not everyone thinks like you and not everyone thinks like me that, you know, if it's an individual who wants it just for themselves and just for their dinner parties, science is scuppered.
It's sort of a Bond villain sort of idea.
Exactly.
I don't know. It'll be interesting to see if someone just says, no, this is going in my ballroom. I mean, what a great ballroom, though. Come on.
Well, there are fossils. There are people who are collectors. There's private collectors who have their own collection. Mm-hmm. They don't make it publicly available. So the precedent is there already that these collectors who spend lots of money. So who knows? It's an interesting debate.
I need to earn another $49,355,000.
And then spend it all on the T-Rex.
Yeah. Ruth, our final story has to do with a meteorite, which I think this is a really interesting story because we don't often and talk about meteorites landing and what they bring.
Yeah.
Set the scene for us.
So set the scene. So 2 years ago in July in New Jersey, there was a massive sonic boom in the sky as a meteor hit the atmosphere. And then a big chunk of that meteorite, about 1.5 kilos in size, went through the roof of a house in New Jersey, Hillsborough, New Jersey. So massive bang, crash. The homeowner happened to be downstairs in the house and they had an amazing presence of mind because they went up to the guest bedroom and opened the door. This smell of sulfur hit their noses and they looked around the room at these pieces of rock all over, you know, between the splintered wood and plaster that was on the floor. They went and got gloves and they wrapped the bits of rock in tinfoil and they put the covered rock into jars and they waited for NASA to come and pick them up. And that is why this story is so amazing, because they really prevented a huge amount of the contamination that happens when, you know, your average meteorite, it hits the Earth, it's somewhere in the middle of nowhere where there are no humans. It just sits there, it dries out, it becomes contaminated with Earth elements. Mm. But this meteorite has been much better preserved. And in fact, it's a very rare meteorite. So it's called a CM1/2 meteorite. So it's a carbon-rich meteorite. That's where the C comes from. And the reason why it's called an M12, so an CM2 meteorite has been modified by water in the early solar system. So way older than Matthew's dinosaur. We're talking this rock is 4.65 billion years old. It's even older than the Earth.
Wow. But
buried inside that CM2 meteorite is bits of CM1 meteorite. And that's even more interesting because that is fragments of rock from the ancient start of the universe that actually spent a considerable amount of time with liquid water seeping through the rock. And that essentially has created a cosmic slow cooker that has been out in space for all these many, many billions of years. And of course, when you have water and minerals together, what do you get? I mean, you get all these really important molecules that are the basis of life. And we've seen this before because as scientists, science has sampled from meteorites out in space. So we've known that there was things like liquid water, organic molecules in these meteorites. But this is a really unique example of, you know, even more unusual things like carboxylic acids, which are the foundation of fatty acids in our bodies. There's loads of different amino acids in this rock, thousands of different organic compounds. But the really unique thing about this is that it's full of sodium-rich minerals, and they're kind of in veins in the rock, which tells us that this meteorite, or when the asteroid that it came from, you know, which was probably about the size of County Longford, it was kind of like a rocky sponge, but actually had water moving through it, salty, briny water. So it almost had a groundwater system. And that was an amazing chemistry lab to create complex molecules. So, you know, this idea, you know, that we sort of had a primordial soup, you know, we all learned that back in school, Earth had this primordial soup and lightning hit it and that created the basis of life. I mean, these meteorites are really telling us that the basis of life is everywhere in the universe. And the idea that it only landed here becomes more and more preposterous, actually.
Yeah.
So it's an amazing find.
Does it tell us anything about whether or not life started in Earth or was brought to Earth, do you think?
Well, I think it tells us that all the basic building blocks of life were brought to Earth. I mean, alongside water, because I mean, that whole debate as to whether all the liquid water on Earth would have burned up when it was formed because it was such a great amounts of heat, and then water was delivered to Earth essentially in meteorites and asteroids
comets hitting
Earth. I mean, I think all of these planetary bodies that have come to Earth have brought with them these building blocks of life. And actually, there was another study this week which looked beyond our own galaxy, which actually found signatures of sugar molecules in the outer beyond our solar system. So I think the building blocks are all there, and they seem to be everywhere in the universe, possibly formed right back at the start of the universe. And then, you know, these, like I said, almost like slow cookers have been traveling around delivering their payloads to maybe planets all over the place.
Very, very interesting. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and Matthew Campbell from Trinity College Dublin, thank you so much. All right, on the way, are bees smarter than we thought? Stay with us. Welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the program, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. We get to all of your comments in the podcast. Listen and subscribe for free in the News Talk app. We've often misunderstood and underestimated the intelligence of animals. And the same goes for insects. It is amazing to me to read the headlines every week from scientific journals that have discovered new cognitive powers of all sorts of beings. And Jussi Kontula, who's from the University of Oulu in Finland, is one of those. He's working with bumblebees. Welcome to the program, Jussi. First off, Why are you working in this field? Why are you interested in the problem-solving powers of bumblebees?
Thanks for having me. I personally am involved in quite purely data science or from a data science perspective. So I am not a biologist, nor was I designing this study. But the reasons are basically those of pure science in general. We're interested about animal cognition and human cognition, and these kinds of studies are the small stepping stones that sort of bring us closer to a good general understanding about these topics.
Right. So in this experiment, you were testing bumblebees, also known as Bombus terrestris, with a problem that they haven't ever seen before. So if you wouldn't mind, and I know you didn't design the study, but maybe you might tell us exactly what was happening.
Yeah, so the bumblebees were naive in the sense that they hadn't had any interactions with the wider world, so to say, before these arena studies that we did. So the only thing that they'd been taught before was that the color blue signifies a reward, a sugar drop, basically, and that they can interact with a styrofoam ball and that, you know, the ball isn't dangerous or anything like that. But they weren't taught any tricks or anything like that. And then in a couple of separate studies, they were let out onto arena where they were sort of supposed to, or they had the possibility to solve a challenge or, you know, a problem that is basically modeled by the century-old curler study that was done with chimpanzees, where bananas were hung from the ceiling and then the chimpanzees had the opportunity to stack boxes to reach for the bananas, and they did it on their own.
Right. So this is an old study studying animal cognition, providing a problem, not giving the animals in question any guidance, and seeing whether or not the animals could figure out that if we stack these boxes on top, these chimpanzees will be able to get the reward, which is the banana. Doing this with bumblebees, though, sounds slightly counterintuitive, because it's presumably not the exact same task, because a bumblebee could just fly up.
Yeah, it's changed to suit the new species being tested. So, for example, that flying problem was dealt with by adjusting the height of the arena so that they simply don't have enough room to fly. So they couldn't just use their wings to reach for the target. They had to climb over something to reach for the artificial flower.
Right. Okay. So they weren't given space to fly, and so they had to solve it by stacking boxes. And they have these bees had never come across this problem before. This was a novel problem for these bees to solve.
It was a novel problem for them. They only knew that the color blue signifies a reward, and that the ball is not, you know, threatening or dangerous to them.
Okay. And so what were we hoping to understand about bees by doing this?
Basically, it's just an experiment that shows that bumblebees can pass the sort of same kind of a cognitive test or, you know, anyway, circumstances that we've agreed for 100 years that chimpanzees can. And from the chimpanzee study, it was a sort of a founding study in animal cognition. It is one of the reasons why we've been talking for decades about chimpanzees being smart or, you know, intelligent. And likewise, there are a couple of other species that have passed similar kind of tests, but this is the first one where invertebrates managed to do it.
So, just if you wouldn't mind, describe exactly what this experiment looks like. What does it look like when the bees are released in? How long do they take to stack the boxes? What are the boxes made of? Just describe it as visually as possible for us, please.
In the first experiment, there's just an open area arena where they can't fly and where the flower is positioned in the ceiling just high enough that they have to do something special to reap the reward.
Bumblebees can figure out how to use a styrofoam ball like a ladder to get food from a fake flower. The flower is on the ceiling of an arena that is too small for them to really fly around. But if they roll the ball into a divot on the floor in just the right spot, they can crawl on top and get their prize. Scientists didn't teach the bumblebees how to solve the puzzle, but they did give them two clues. One, that this blue dot means food, and two, that this styrofoam ball can move. More than 70% of bees solved the puzzle, even when the flower was hidden inside a small room.
There's sort of a point for most of the bees where they've gone through, you know, every place they could get to on the arena and, you know, mapped it for themselves. When they stop doing that, and then quite quickly, over a matter of, let's say, 10 seconds or less, they move the ball below under the reward and climb over the ball and then reach for the reward.
Right. So, I mean, it's interesting that the bees sort of needed to map out the area first. And that presumably is expected behavior. If you're in a new environment, it's expected that they do that.
In part, it's just their default behavior. So they find themselves somewhere and they, you know, look around and study, and they use smells and stuff like that to figure out where they are and what they can do.
So, I mean, to me, I suppose I'm not surprised by this, because we're continuously supposedly surprised by the intelligence of animals and insects every single week or month, as I said in the intro. Yep. But we have to remember that, you know, insects are often considered to be intelligent because of their collective intelligence. The size of a sesame seed, these really, yep, really tiny brains, yep, are able to piece things together and problem solve. And I suppose that it's extraordinary that in some respects that we didn't know that before, that they could do this. But at the same time,
in some respects, we do know, or we can guess at this stuff. You know, most dog owners rightly think that, hey, my dog is a little bit intelligent. But the difficult part is to, you know, quantify it and make a scientific result out of it.
Yeah. And that's your role. Tell me a little bit about your role in terms of the data, because people listening to this might just look at it and say, well, is your job just a stopwatch? But what is the role of a data specialist in something like this?
My role was to feed the videos that were recorded of the arenas with the bees. I fed them to a computer program that detected the bee and the ball locations from the video, so that we could create heat maps and otherwise statistically analyze the behavior to sort of make their movement something we can, you know, wrap on to. There's several hours of videos in total, so it's just easier and more robust to analyze it with computers.
Is this the most complicated task a bee has solved? I feel like the waggle dance is probably a more complicated behavior that we see naturally in the wild, even though I think its specificity has been slightly questioned.
The waggle dance is I agree it's more complex, but it can be explained without these, you know, problem-solving capabilities as something that comes ultimately from the genes of the bees.
Honeybees have some fascinating abilities, among them being able to communicate by performing a unique dance. It informs hive mates where a newly discovered food source is located. Every cycle of this waggle dance roughly describes the shape of the figure eight.
It does make you wonder what we really know about intelligence when it comes to animals, because of these constant impressive tasks that once we look It turns out they can
do. Yeah, and we struggle just with defining our own intelligence. Mm. I mean, to define it in rigorous scientific terms.
Were there any variations on the experiment done that failed?
With this particular study, the success rate of the bees was surprisingly good. So in the three different experiments or different arenas, different tasks that they were presented with, the success rate was steadily above 70%. There were no failed arena experiments, something that we tried and then just decided that this isn't working. So perhaps there was a bit of luck and, of course, good design in the study, but it progressed pretty straightforwardly.
So just to be clear, the bees were never taught to move the ball beneath the flower. They saw the ball, they saw the flower, and they knew that the flower was a reward. And so they looked around their area, then realized the ball was the route to go higher to reach the reward. And that is something brand new that you've never seen in bees before.
That's it in a nutshell.
Really, really cool. I mean, just a simple experiment, but one that you don't really know the answer to until you ask. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for joining us, Jussi.
Thank you for having me.
Jussi Kontula there from the University of Oulu in Finland. All right, that's it from us on this week's episode of Future Proof. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey and Micheál O'Connell for producing, Rory Galvin on podcast, and Stephen McLoone on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae. Proudly supported by Research Ireland. Sunday from midday. News Talk. Conversation that counts.